Hello, OT friends, and welcome to the Uncommon OT series. I'm Patricia Modis, and I'm your host, a Filipino-American, native New Yorker, currently based in Los Angeles, bulldog mama, and an uncommon occupational therapist myself for the past 22 years. On this podcast, you will hear me proudly feature the unique careers of occupational therapy practitioners working in non-traditional and rural emerging practice areas, settings where OT is uncommon. I invite you to receive a dose of OT inspiration to learn, to think outside of the box, and to be energized and motivated to follow in these unconventional paths. Happy listening. Before we dive into today's episode, I want to highlight and extend a special thanks to TrueLearn and Picmonic, our sponsors. Picmonic is a visual mnemonic learning tool that's been research proven to increase retention and help students ace their exams. It uses audio-visual learning and intelligence-based repetition algorithms that really help with long-term retention while studying. It is an excellent learning resource and study aid for OT and OTA students. Picmonic has built a better way for students to prepare for tests, whether you're studying for classes or getting ready for the NVCOT exam. Try it for yourself and sign up today using the link in the show notes and using the code TRANSITIONSOT to score a discount of 20% off of your Picmonic membership. Happy studying! Welcome back, OT friends. Today, I am extra thrilled to introduce you to our guest of honor, Dr. Michael C. Dr. C is a Filipino occupational therapist and occupational scientist from the University of the Philippines in Manila, with a current post with the Institute of Occupational Therapy at the Zurich University of Applied Sciences in Switzerland. His PhD work and practice revolve around occupational therapy and research centered around culture, substance, addiction, rehabilitation, social and justice determinants of health, and interprofessional education and collaborative practice in diverse health and social care settings. So to tell us more about his uncommon OT work, without further ado, I'd like to present you Dr. Michael C. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Mike.
Thank you very much, Patricia, for having me in this podcast. I'm so excited about this. We've been waiting for this, and finally it's happening. So thank you.
Yes, thank you, particularly for your patience with scheduling. I know we're on completely different time zones, but we made it work and found, you know, a mutually convenient time. So I really appreciate, you know, you taking the time to tell us about your work. It's so rich. There's so much to talk about. So I can't wait to delve in. But as usual, as we start our episode, I'd love for you to just share a little bit about your background and maybe some of your favorite occupations with our listeners.
Okay. You've already mentioned that in the intro, but I am a Filipino occupational therapist. So I studied, trained, and worked there as an OT before moving here to Switzerland. But I started as an OT clinician. So I worked with children and in the community for the first 5 to 6 years of my practice. And then I realized after 5 or 6 years that I needed to do something more. And I thought of going into teaching, because I thought that when I share my experience in practice to students, let's say 25 or 30 students, then there will be 30 more people who will support and help and provide care to the people, to more people. So mm-hmm. I thought it would have, you know, more impact. I thought, so if I go into teaching, and I can do that. So I went into teaching. I started as an instructor part-time, and then I started loving it. I went into a master's degree in health professions education to upskill myself, to learn more about the teaching and learning process. Mm-hmm. So my master's was not in OT, so it was in education. And because I wanted to be a good educator. So mm-hmm. And then, of course, when you're doing your master's, you are introduced to research. And then I thought that, yeah, I think I can do more. I can do research. And one of an OT who I really respect told me that if you want to become a professor in the academe, you need to do a PhD. So I did that. I did that from 2016 to 2019. I went to Tokyo, Japan to do my PhD full time. So it was under a scholarship. So I had to live and study there and do my research. And then, yeah, so that was my trajectory. I went back to teaching in the Philippines in 2020. And I stayed there for 3 years. I was not teaching in OT school, but I was doing that on the side. But I taught in graduate school for health professions education. And I stayed there for 3 years. I really enjoyed my time going back. But I think, like I always ask myself, do I think I can do more? So I moved to Switzerland this year. To go back to OT, teaching and doing research in OT.
I love it. Care to share a few of your favorite occupations?
Okay. Of course, on top of what I'm doing, on top of my work, I really like forest bathing. Of course, hiking in the forest, I think it really helps me relax and reflect. So I think doing that is very important for me right now, and also having coffee conversations with close friends, with a small group of friends. I think I really like that because and not talking about work, but just talking about life. That's very important for me. And lastly, well, among other things, would be working out. That's also something I really, really like doing.
Well, thanks so much for sharing some of that and for introducing me to forest bathing because I'm definitely interested and very much look forward to the next time I'm around trees. So thank you. So, Dr. Mike, can you share with us what motivated you to join or to participate in the podcast? I reached out to you and invited you, but what was it about sharing your journey that was interesting to you?
Well, of course, when you reach out to me, I immediately went into your website and I went through them and I looked into who you were interviewing, you who you were talking to, and some of them I know. So I feel safe. Like, okay, I should accept this invitation because you've been interviewing people who have interesting backgrounds, diverse experiences. And I thought that, okay, maybe I could share something to your audience. And the title itself is really very interesting. You said it's uncommon. And to me, as an OT, we might be having a shared goal, but we do different things. And I think that's the yeah, I would like to share something uncommon for many of our colleagues in the profession.
And I invited you precisely for that reason because you have something to share that's uncommon that we haven't quite, explored yet on this podcast. So again, thanks for being here with us. So this might be a great segue into, having you describe to us a little bit about your uncommon OT work and take it away.
Okay, thank you about that. Of course, I might not be able to. I don't have any structure or script here, but the thing that is uncommon for me, as an OT is, I do OT not necessarily with patient care or right now, but I use my voice and I am engaged in conversations like this. So it can be formal, like conferences or writing an academic paper, also being in informal forum with different professionals, or I can also do lectures for students, or I'm invited for a radio or television interviews, podcasts like this, and just talking about occupational therapy. And I think although I'm not always paid to do that, but there are opportunities where I get paid to speak, have conversations about occupational therapy. And I think that is something that in our profession has not been talked about a lot. You can actually create a career or a work in public speaking in occupational therapy. And I think that is, I mean, of course, I don't really talk about it a lot, like transparently, that so, people pay me to talk. So, but that's something that, of course, there is a small group of OTs who also do the same thing, but this is something uncommon, and maybe some people, it might be their first time to hear that. Oh, so you get paid to do these things, to talk for 30 minutes, or to be a consultant for an organization that is not necessarily OT but needs an occupational perspective. So yeah. Yeah, I think that's one.
And that is, I think, a really important point, right? That yes, this can be something that can supplement your current situation, and at the same time, you're also spreading the good word about occupational therapy and having the conversations that need to be had.
Yes, exactly. And I think, as a researcher, I think it's important for people to also know that we are researchers. We're not just confined in the lab or looking at statistics or writing papers, but we are actually we use our skills to thread stories and make things more easy, or we make things more integrated so we can communicate it to the public. So if that makes sense. So we are our skills, we use it to communicate science. So and there are a lot of opportunities in doing that as well. And also you can get paid to do that. I mean, this is because maybe this is something that people don't know, and I think, yeah, and I'm here to maybe share a little bit about that.
Definitely, that's what we want to know about. But I just want to say, you're so perfectly suited for this role. You're such a clear communicator. You're such a clear explainer. Obviously, that probably is rooted from your teaching, right? Your love for teaching, and education, your training, and that. But it, when you and I speak, you always somehow explain things to me in a way that sort of breaks it down because I'm really not a researcher. A natural. I'm not a natural like you. But you're able to break it down in terms of, the work that you do and break it down to me with clarity and really with very, specific examples. So I appreciate that, and I hope that that's something that our listeners also take away from this conversation, right? Talking about research and how, yes, we're not just in the lab writing papers all the time and, passing out surveys and collecting data. You can also talk about that research, and I think that's part of the responsibility is to share your data, to share your research, and that can be done through these public speaking opportunities that you mentioned. So maybe can we segue into your path a little bit? How did you get from, I know you talked a little bit about how you reached the point of teaching and, sort of discovered the love for research. How do you then bridge into, okay, now let me talk about my research, and How did people find you, and how did you let the world know that you're available for such conversations?
Well, you're asking me if how where it all started as a researcher and how I'm doing what I'm doing now.
Yes.
Right. I think one of the biggest contributor to this, like people getting to know who I am, what I do, is through social media. I think that's really the one. Of course it is, of course when you publish something in the it will be available online and people would read that. But of course when you share that in social media, then more people could look into what you're doing. And maybe in a smaller group, of course, I also invest in attending conferences. I always think of it as an investment, because sometimes you are self-funding yourself. Not all the time you are funded. But I started as I was still a clinician at that time, but I was engaged in little projects, research projects, and at the time, I was self-funding myself to attend conferences. And in conferences, you get to know people, important people, also who might be your mentor or might be a partner, a collaborator in any way. And from there, your network grows, coupled with social media presence. And then, of course, as I go along, as I matured in my career, I realized that, oh, it's also good to invest in having your own website. Because all the things that you do personally, professionally, and on your private time, you could put there. Because, of course, if you have a company or if you're in a university, you can put everything in your profile. But if you have your own website that you pay every year, then you're allowed to have your own copyright. You can put all the things, curate them in your website, and that's where people can contact you directly. And of course, your name, if they type your name or they type a description of what you're doing, then they can find you. And there are many ways on doing that. But I started attending conferences. This is where I started. And then I just and when you meet people, you'll learn from them. Like, oh, so you have a Twitter account before. Oh, you have a have LinkedIn. Oh, I should also have my own. So I do social learning a lot. I learn from my environment, not necessarily in the classroom all the time, but yeah, sometimes you copy the good things that you learn from others.
I'm a big believer in that too. And, very much agree with the impact of social media and how that can really be combined, right? To reach, just to be able to reach the individuals that we're trying to reach. So wonderful. Thanks for, sharing with us a little bit about that and how folks are able to find you and how you're able to kind of market what you're doing. Are you able to, can you describe for us a typical day for you? The typical day like as a researcher?
I wake up at 7:30 or 8, and I have my breakfast. I normally have sandwich bread and eat my and drink my vitamins, and then I go to work. I just bike now to go to work. It's just 5 minutes away from my place. And I start with checking my emails. That's where I start my day. And of course you have meetings. You have formal meetings like the scheduled ones. And as a researcher, you also have opportunities to have dialogues and discourses with fellow researchers in the team, PhD students, master's students. And the topics that you talk about can vary. It could be as simple as how do you Disseminate your research on social media. Like I publish something, how do you disseminate that? So it can be like that, a conversation, or it can be methodological. They can ask like, okay, how do you do content or thematic analysis? What tools do you use, etc. So it can be like that, or it can be as casual as, hey, I attended this conference, or I watched this news from television, and what do you think about this? So sharing of opinions, and what are
Okay.
your thoughts on these things? And yeah, and of course there is humor sprinkled around these conversation, and that's very important. And then you write, you read. Being a researcher requires a lot of reading, observing, and listening, not just writing. I think the reason why, maybe you mentioned a while ago, that why do researchers or teachers speak with such clarity? I think it is not because they're good in speaking, but they're also very good in listening and observing. Because when you listen and you observe, you reflect. And you try to arrange that in your mind before saying it. And before you saying it's already organized. And I think that's something that we do. So there are times if you're asking about my day or my week, once a week I stay in the library to have time to read and okay, what's new? Or I have a question, and I think I need to read this critical essay about the topic I want to write about.
Got it.
So having time to read, because you cannot write anything if you don't read. So I think that is very important. Even for practitioners, for clinicians, you need to read your patient's records. You need to read about their condition from journals, from textbooks, from popular media, and what is this all about before you can, before meeting them or while you're meeting them. And so you can be giving your practice or your service with information or informed service. So yeah, that's my typical day. So what else? It can be boring sometimes. It's not always exciting. Just giving you real talk. It's not always exciting. This is a typical day of a researcher, but for me, it might be boring for people if you listen to me like talking, oh, that's such a boring life. But for me, it's having the opportunity and time to read and write. It's very fulfilling for me.
And thanks for, highlighting that, right? Because I think there's probably researchers out there listening who are going, yes, we love research. And because it's something that excites you, and again, it's something that you feel really passionate about, right? And I love that you kind of connected it with listening and observing. And as you were saying that, I just immediately thought, ding, 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 an OT skill set, right? And that's kind of makes you more really well suited for this researcher role because you have that lens. So thanks for highlighting that too. Any other OT skills that you utilize in this role?
Skills. Maybe one is visualization. I also do graphic design on the side. I really like graphics. I'm not an artist, okay? Maybe people would think you're not an artist. But I have a lens for aesthetics, and maybe that does not qualify to be an artist, but I really like making sure that the visual helps communicate information. And I am very keen with colors, with lines. Whenever I present a PowerPoint presentation or create a poster or just, posting, even posting in social media, I'm very keen with, I use icons. I don't know if you will notice it if you visit my LinkedIn. I use icons to indicate that this is something that's very important, or I put a red circle, or and yeah, I like what do you call that? Design skills? Is that I have that. I didn't study art school. I liked art, but I'm in science now, but I think I can still use that. And I'm an OT. It's an art and science.
Yes.
Why not? So
Exactly. And you
yeah.
know, again, I heard OT there again.
Yes.
Making sure that you're communicating in the just right way to
Yes.
whomever you're communicating to, right? And making sure that you're
Yeah.
actually being effective in
Yeah.
delivering that message.
Yes, exactly. So yeah, that's a skill that I thought I will forget forever. But I realized that oh, okay, so my artsy side, I can use it in my role as a researcher, because when you create presentations, it has to be, it's not just text there. There has to be some imagery, visualization to communicate what you want to say.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you know, relating it back to what you're talking about, public speaking, I mean, you have to be able to relate to your audience.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly.
Like through presentation, eye contact, body language, and all of these things that we talk about in our
Yeah.
OT day-to-day
Yep.
sessions with folks, at least I do.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, a lot of my OT skills I use now in research. Yeah, like activity analysis. This is very important. Being organized, labeling things, being, sequencing, planning, and feed forward feedback. I mean, knowing these skills, you are able to still use it in research a lot of
Well, thanks for naming those.
yeah
Again, there's probably research listeners out there, OT researcher listeners out there who are just clapping in the air right now. And also, you know, there are, I know many OTs are very much interested in going into research. So again, highlighting these skills, I think, is also really helpful for them.
Yep.
So can you tell us some recent highs or successes or recent lows that you've had in your work as a researcher?
Okay. We start with highs. So yeah, I think the recent high was we were able to publish a paper yesterday. Yeah, and
Congrats.
thank you very much. That is in OTJR, the OT Journal of Research, which is based in the US. And the title of that is, I'm gonna look at it. Okay, here it is. It is entitled Unraveling the Greener Pasture Concept, the Phenomenology of Internationally Educated Occupational Therapists. So it's open access, so everyone can read that. So this is a high for me, of course. It has been a work for 5 years, and it's just today or yesterday that we got it out. But it's really hard work. That's why I feel elated seeing that out there and published. So this is a high for me, and it's because it talks about stories of Filipino OTs working abroad. So it's something that I think many would be able to relate.
Yes, I'm
Yeah.
excited to delve into it myself. So thank you, and we will
Yes.
make sure we include that link on our show notes so our listeners can have access to it too.
Exactly. Where when it comes to lows, does it lows in the research work that I do?
If any.
Oh, okay. I
Or
think
challenges, maybe
or
challenges might be it.
challenges, yeah. Oh, of course. One of the challenges that I'm currently facing is how to do the research work when there is, not enough people in the team to do that and deadlines. I think this is very important to maybe share with you because if the research is funded, normally there is a timeline for that, and there's a timeline for all the processes like collection. You need to finish it at this time, you need to publish it at this time because it's funded, and the funder expects you to do that, just that. And but in reality, it's not an ideal world out there. Sometimes people go, or because research assistants in universities, they are usually in contracts. They're not in permanent, they don't have permanent positions normally. And PhD students don't also have permanent positions. They are only there for 3, 4 years or 5 years. After that,
Got it.
they're not in the university unless they get hired. So normally, if there are transitions like this, people go, new people come, and you need to train new people and reorient them with what's happening with the research, and they come in the middle of it. And yeah, so this takes a lot of time, energy, and and sometimes frustration. I think I would like to say that it can be frustrating sometimes if you don't meet the deadline. It could be very frustrating. Asking for an extension is good, but it can build up with the other work that you have, and it can be very challenging. And I will just mention this, but I will not elaborate, but funding can also be a challenge for many of the researchers because sometimes you need to get things done even if you're not paid anymore. I mean, you have hours to clock in and you're paid in this hour, but hey, there's just so much to do. And sometimes you need to do extra work without getting paid. So sometimes this is an issue.
Well, thank you for sharing that. This might be a good time to kind of segue into what you just mentioned, which is funding, right? Or any kinds of money matters that you'd care to mention. How does one get funding? You also mentioned doing some public speaking on the side, talking about your work, and what does, you know, how does compensation look in these types of situations? So you can pick and choose where you want to begin and what you want to share.
Well, the research work or the job of becoming a researcher vary from different countries. So I can only speak maybe based on my experience in the Philippines and also my experience here in Europe. But I think the system in Europe may be similar to the United States, I think. So here, you get funding when you first apply for a grant. So your grant is an idea that you want to do research on, and you apply for it, and you propose a budget for it. It can be as small as $20,000 to $1 million. It can vary. It can be a small grant, it can be a big grant. It depends also on the timeline. So a big grant would normally be 5 years. A small grant would be 6 months. Could be like this. And the grant, when you win it, we call it win. When you win the grant, it means that it will be given to you. The money will be given to you, and it's like it's given to your account, not your personal account, but you will have an account where this money needs to be distributed in accordance to the budget proposal that you submitted and approved.
Got it.
So you will use the fund to pay for your research assistants, your master's students, PhD students. You will pay for the data, like softwares, equipment, infrastructure, travels, conferences, you will use this money to fund your work,
Yes.
what you're doing. And normally this is how it's like you're running your own company.
It sounds like it. And in
Yes, it's
terms
this.
of, sequencing and data, kind of organization, that it just,
Exactly. So
became
even
very
the
clear to me.
yeah, especially like even buying like you put the budget, the printers,
Yes.
how much items you need for your laboratory. That's why you're called a principal investigator, because you're the head of it, and you're basically doing project management. And then so you can do, that's why there's what you call academic freedom. You're free to do whatever you want because you have the money to do what you want, to innovate, to create, to generate knowledge. So this is where we get funding in European universities and most R1 universities in the United States. This is like R1 is research intensive universities in the United States. So normally this is how you get funding. But there are also funding from your salary.
Yes.
Of course, when you're hired, you have a certain level of salary, and in 100%, like in 5 days, you are given a percentage of the 100% to do research. So that's your payment for doing research, and that can be another pathway to also get funded to do research. I think this is more applicable in the Philippines, or in my country. You get a percentage of your work, and you're paid within your salary a percentage to do research.
Got it.
Of course, you
Okay.
can also apply for funding, so that's an additional, but normally here in Europe it can be both. But to sustain your career, or if you really want to be a professor, you need to have funding.
Yes.
Like you need to win grants, because it allows you to do a lot of things, create your own laboratories. Like you will have your own laboratory. So if you have more money, then you can sustain that laboratory. You can have a group of PhD students doing the research that you like. So that's why there's like this. There's a
Yes.
there's hierarchy, and of course I don't want to go into these complicated things about funding, but yeah, this is how we get funding, either through grants and through salary. And also, you mentioned about your side hustles.
Yes.
Of course, these are just side hustles. These are not our main income. But when you are good at what you do, and when you've done, and when you have proven people or the public that you've done a lot in this area, you become a quote unquote expert.
Yes.
And as we all know, in knowledge, in terms of evidence level, expert opinion is at the bottom. They say it's at the bottom, and it's considered evidence when an expert says something. And people normally would pay you to speak as a keynote speaker in a conference, or they invite you to do a lecture in a university. Per hour, they pay you per hour. Or these are payments that they ask you to do something for them, for a group of people, a university, and they pay you to do that. And I've had several opportunities where I get paid to share my knowledge and expertise. Yep.
Thank you for sharing that. I think that's really obviously, as an OT, I've been to conferences and I've, listened to keynote speakers and often wondered to myself, like, obviously these are individuals who are very respected in the field, right? Who have knowledge to bring to the table, such as yourself. But it's really nice to get an idea of how do you sort of go that direction? How do you follow that path?
And I just want to add, Patricia, that it's not an easy path, or it's not for everyone. And it takes a lot of longevity.
Mm.
It's not just about, being popular, or it's not just about having influence. It's not just that, but it's longevity, and integrity in the work that you do. And I think the people that we see in key, like keynote speakers, these people have done a lot of groundwork before they became that.
Yes,
Before
and they
people.
still are doing, they are still doing the work, correct?
They're still doing the work. They're never, lying down or just relaxing. They're still doing the work. And I think people, it's like putting value on these people. You're different. That's why we want you to be there. And we will, just to be there, we will pay for you just to be there.
Yeah.
Just so you can talk to us or something like that. I mean, I'm not on that level, but this is something that I'm also still learning about. And it has always been a eureka moment for me, like, oh, okay, so people would really just want to pick my brain, and they're willing to, they're giving value to this, to my brain,
Yes.
to my insights, to my reflection. So yeah, I never thought that this could be a supplemental way of an income, you can call it that, or yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Oh, I love it. Do you have any other career advice for our listeners who may want to follow in your footsteps?
Okay. My advice, and this is just based on my personal experience. So if you want to go this path where people respect you and value you, whether they respect, valuing means they listen to you. It doesn't have to be paid all the time, but listen to you, spend time with you. I started by volunteering. This is where I all started. When people don't know me, didn't know me, or when people, like, I'm just Mike. Or I'm still Mike right now, but it's, no one knows you. You're just, fresh from college, from the university. No one really knows you, and you like to speak, but who will listen to you? Wants to listen to someone who just graduated, just finished internship a month ago. I started volunteering, Patricia. I did free work for people. I started by going into mentorship. So I sought mentors, like, okay, I shadowed. So I was shadowing, can I join you? Can I attend this? Can I assist you? Can I be your, like, can I, if you need any help, I'll be your assistant. So started like an apprentice or something like that, and I did a lot of volunteering because I have so much respect with the people who were ahead of me. Like, I really like what they are doing, and I want to be like them. And how do you start? You start by free service. And this free service is not, it's not a win-lose situation. It's a win-win because you observe, you listen to how they talk, you listen, you get a VIP pass for the insights that they share with other people. And that really helped me learn how to navigate the world of academia. Yeah, by being an apprentice, volunteering, and just I started with that. And from there, when people trust you and they see your work ethic, integrity, that's where people will recommend you. And these big people have a value already in society. And once they see something in you, they will start to recommend you. And when that happens, that's where you can start doing your thing, your own thing. And they will be your mentors. My real mentors would really tell you, you can now fly. You can now fly. So I think that's my career advice. Just humility, I think, and generosity. I think that's,
Such great advice. I also heard you, I heard in how in what you were describing a lot of motivation, a lot of motivation to learn, right? And I think when that comes across to the teacher, that also is another win-win, right? Teachers love to love students who are sponges, who are, willing to digest everything and also just really willing to learn. So I think that you demonstrated in turn, they saw your commitment to the cause. And yeah, such wonderful advice. And, not to mention also that you feed into that, right? Like this, the energy, the momentum, like there's a lot of energy and in that collaboration, and a lot of learning. So thank you for highlighting those. Can you share any common myths or misconceptions that there may be out there about being a research or doing public speaking or any of the things that you might have mentioned?
Myths, okay. Okay, there is, of course, when you're a researcher or when you're in academia, people would always maybe refer to Dexter's Laboratory or that cartoon where you always wear glasses. Of course, that could be true. Wear glasses, you wear floppy clothes, and you don't have any sense of fashion, or you don't look, or you don't take a bath or something like that. I mean, that could be very, yeah, there are stereotypes about researchers, but I think I would like to dispel that because, or demystify that because I like I mentioned a while ago, I work out, I try to do forest ba bathing, I ski, I hike, I mean, I do activities, active things, because I think when you're physically healthy or fit, it helps your mind, it helps you think better. So I think, yeah, there's a misconception about researchers, just in the lab, not sleeping, looking tired all the time, and not taking care of. I think it is more important that we take care of ourselves because our brain is always working.
Yes.
We need to sleep, we need to move, and yeah, and to be an effective researcher, you need to take care of yourself. So I think that's something that I'd like to demystify about researchers.
Well,
Yeah.
again, spoken like a true OT, and how the mind and the body and the spirit work in conjunction.
And
And
another
also,
thing that I'd like to add, Patricia, maybe a misconception is researchers are know-it-alls. Yeah, maybe because they think, oh, he must be, smart, a smart ass, if you can call it, or someone who knows it all. Yes, there could be some people in research who may act that way. And I'm really sorry that if you experience something like that. And but based on my observation, the real scholars of our time, especially in occupational therapy and occupational science, the real ones are the ones who would say, I actually don't know everything. You tell me what you know. And maybe I learn from you. And they're listeners rather than speakers more. And this is what I said. Real researchers listen, reflect, and observe more than just talking. So yeah, that's something that I'd like to dispel for everyone. Yeah.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Mike, for your time and for sharing with us your story. I am blessed to have you on the podcast, my fellow Pinoy. It's really important for me to highlight and elevate your work because not only are you my kababayan, whom to our English-speaking listeners means fellow countrymen, fellow country person, and to elevate the work that you're doing and really, again, promote you because I'm super proud of you and the work that you're doing there. So again, thank you so much. And if our listeners were interested in following you, looking you up, checking out your website and the visual aesthetics that you've added there, how do we find you?
Okay, they can always find me on LinkedIn. You can just type Michael C. We're friends on LinkedIn, so maybe if they look up at your profile, they can find me there. My handle is at Dr. Mike or DrMikeSyot. That's my handle for my Twitter and also my Facebook. And I have my website. It's www.drmikesyot.com. So you can follow me there. Everything is linked. And of course, I'd love to collaborate with any one of you if you have any questions about what I'm doing as a researcher or, yeah, just about this conversation. I'd love to connect.
Thank you so much again for your time.
Welcome. Always welcome.
And that wraps up another inspiring episode of the Uncommon OT series. Connect with me at www.transitionsot.com. And don't forget to sign up to be part of the Transitions OT community. By doing so, you'll receive my latest compiled list of Uncommon OT practice settings, the latest news on mentoring offerings, Uncommon OT live events, non-traditional OT resources, and more. You may also follow me on my social media pages on Instagram and LinkedIn. And if you love this episode, head on over to Spotify, Stitcher, Apple, and Google Podcasts to follow, rate, and leave a review. I also ask you to consider pledging your support to my passion podcast project by being a patron on Patreon. It is very much appreciated. Sending big OT love. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.